BBC World Service, welcome to World Briefing with Fiona MacDonald. The headlines at 7 o'clock. The UN Secretary-General Kofi Annan is on his way to the Middle East, but as the Israeli deadline nears for the Palestinians to stop their protests, the violence shows no sign of abating. Sanctions against Serbia should be lifted by the European Union following the downfall of Slobodan Milosevic. Political parties in Belgium join forces against a far right-wing party which made big gains in elections in the Dutch-speaking region of Flanders. More on all those stories, plus a museum dedicated to the life of John Lennon opens to the public in Japan today on what would have been the former Beatles' 60th birthday. This is the BBC in London. First, we'll have a roundup of the latest world news.
BBC News with Roger Maud. The United Nations Secretary-General, Kofi Annan, is on his way to the Middle East to try to end 11 days of escalating violence between Israeli troops and Palestinian demonstrators. He's expected to meet both the Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, and the Palestinian leader, Yasser Arafat. A UN spokesman said Mr. Annan's trip was arranged hurriedly because he sees a risk of the violence worsening. John Lyne reports from Jerusalem.
Kofi Annan's mission is part of a rising tempo of peace efforts on the day Israel's deadline to the Palestinians to end the violence is due to expire. There's even talk in Washington of President Clinton organising a summit meeting later in the week. There is one small sign of success. The Americans are helping the Israelis and Palestinians to monitor a ceasefire agreed in Gaza. The level of violence there and across the West Bank has declined, although overnight there were more reports of unrest. An Arab man died after an attack by Israelis in the town of Nazareth, and the body of a Jewish settler was discovered near Nablus. On Israel's border with Lebanon, a tense standoff continues, while intermediaries try to negotiate the release of three Israeli soldiers kidnapped by the Hezbollah guerrilla group on Saturday.
European Union foreign ministers meeting in Luxembourg today are expected to lift some of the EU's sanctions on Serbia, just days after the downfall of Slobodan Milosevic and the installation of Vojislav Koštunica as president. Janet Barry reports.
The foreign ministers are expected to lift the embargoes on oil imports to Yugoslavia and flights to Western Europe by the Yugoslav airline. But they're more cautious about lifting all the financial sanctions. They say they need time to ensure this wouldn't benefit companies that bankrolled the Milosevic regime. And for the same reason, they'll be reluctant to lift the imposition of visas for Yugoslav citizens travelling to the EU. One EU official has said they don't want to see Milosevic's backers travelling to Europe as tourists or refugees. EU officials say now, though, it's vital Yugoslavia feels it's a part of Europe. Vojislav Koštunica has been invited to meet EU leaders at their summit in Biarritz at the end of the week. And that could be when they announce the release of over $2 billion worth of aid over the next 7 years.
Mainstream political parties in Belgium have reiterated their refusal to cooperate with the far-right party, the Vlaams Blok, following its local election victories in the Dutch-speaking region of Flanders. The Prime Minister, Guy Verhofstadt, said the agreement to isolate the Vlaams Blok would prevent it from holding power. The party, which wants independence for Flanders and an end to all immigration, took 33% of the vote in Antwerp, Belgium's second biggest city. You're listening to the news from the BBC. The future direction of China's economic reforms is expected to top the agenda as China's senior leaders sit down today for the opening of the annual Communist Party plenum. The meeting will also focus attention on who will replace President Jiang Zemin and other top leaders who are due to retire in 2 years' time. Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports from Beijing.
Despite 20 years of economic reform, China's annual Communist Party plenum remains shrouded in secrecy. Even its location, a hotel on the western edge of Beijing, is never officially acknowledged. Only the black limousine slipping in and out and large numbers of extra police give any clue of what's going on inside. How exactly these meetings work and what's on the agenda, no one knows for sure. Those invited are the 350 members of China's powerful Communist Party Central Committee. The economy is expected to top the agenda. China's imminent entry into the World Trade Organization will pose major new challenges to the country's outdated state-run industries and indebted banking system. Corruption is also a key issue. Despite a three-year war on government corruption, it continues to grow.
Tension is rising in Zimbabwe ahead of the return of the main opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, who faces arrest when he arrives back from South Africa in a few hours' time. Mr. Tsvangirai is expected to be detained on subversion charges following remarks he made at a rally in Harare a week ago. At the time, he warned that if President Robert Mugabe did not leave office voluntarily, he would be removed by force. Mr. Tsvangirai's party, the Movement for Democratic Change, said his arrest would be a dangerous move. Pictures released in Colombia show more than 250 police and soldiers being held by rebels in secret detention camps have caused uproar. The country's largest rebel group, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, released the first ever video images of their captives in camps surrounded by barbed wire and watchtowers. BBC News.
It's 6 minutes past seven GMT. You're listening to the BBC World Service with Fiona MacDonald. Tension in the Middle East remains high as Israel observes its most sacred religious holiday, Yom Kippur. The deadline set by the Israeli Prime Minister for the Palestinian protests to stop is fast approaching, with no sign of violence abating. Late on Sunday night, the death toll from the recent clashes rose again when an Israeli Arab was killed in Nazareth. The UN Secretary-General is sufficiently worried to have set off for the region in person. Nick Childs reports from Jerusalem.
As dusk fell on Sunday, the siren sounded across Jerusalem to signify the start of Yom Kippur, and Israelis marked the holiest day in the Jewish calendar with a deep sense of foreboding. Many remember how war with the Arabs erupted on the same day in 1973. And in the new crisis which is scarring this region, the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak once again warned the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat that he has until Monday night to stop the Palestinian protests.
If by the end of these 2 days we will not see a calming down of the situation, we will draw the conclusion that Arafat deliberately has decided to abandon the peace process and is preferring a deadlock and confrontation.
For most of Sunday in Gaza and the West Bank, disturbances were sharply down, even while Palestinian leaders like Nabil Shaath continue to parade their sense of injustice.
There is one party shooting, and that is the Israeli party. Yesterday, that party sent into Gaza 30 tanks with four bulldozers, attacked, shot, and destroyed every building in the center of Gaza around the so-called settlement of Nitzarim.
But on Saturday night in Tiberias and again on Sunday night in Nazareth, it was the anger of Israeli Jews which boiled over in attacks on Arabs and their property. And an increasingly beleaguered Mr. Barak faces another dangerous challenge across Israel's border with Lebanon, with the abduction of three Israeli soldiers by the Shiite group Hezbollah. Still, the Prime Minister insisted Israel would emerge from the swirl of events surrounding this solemn holiday, although he issued another warning.
I have some experience in fighting through Yom Kippur 27 years ago. Everything seemed to be really desperate, and we came out victorious out of these tougher conditions. We have passed since then the Intifada, the Lebanon, we passed many crises before then. We are experienced both in war, but we want to make peace.
Just 5 months after Mr. Barak ended the long nightmare of Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon, Israeli tanks have been moving north towards the border again. With talk of contacts involving the Red Cross and Germany to try to free the Israeli soldiers, there's still time to prevent this crisis escalating further, but probably not much time.
That was Nick Childs in Jerusalem. Representatives of the separatist movement in the Indonesian province of Irian Jaya, or Western Papua, have accused the police of provoking the violence in the central town of Wamena on Friday, in which up to 30 people were killed. The conflict erupted after the police pulled down separatist flags which had been flying in the area. Hundreds of people have been evacuated from Wamena district to prevent any further bloodshed. Our Jakarta correspondent Richard Galpin reports.
A spokesman for the Papua Presidium, which represents independent supporters in Irian Jaya, told journalists that the central government's policy on the flying of the separatist flag, the Morning Star, had become extremely unclear. He said their understanding was that the Indonesian president himself, Abdurrahman Wahid, had allowed it. But he said the police in Irian Jaya were now trying to stop it, with, he said, the approval of Vice President Megawati Sukarnoputri, who recently visited the province. He also expressed fears that the armed forces were preparing to crack down on the independence movement, with extra troops being sent to the region along with military aircraft, which had been flying low over towns in an apparent show of force. In Wamena itself, the security forces have now regained control, but the atmosphere remains extremely tense. Military transport aircraft are reported to have been used to fly hundreds of migrants out of the area. People from other parts of Indonesia living in Wamena were the target of the pro-independence militia, which went on the rampage on Friday after the separatist flags were torn down by the police and fighting broke out.
Richard Galpin reporting from Jakarta. New research in Vietnam indicates that an increasing number of children in the country are suffering from obesity. The Centre for Nutrition in Ho Chi Minh City has found that 12.5% of children in the city are obese and that the figure is rising. Meanwhile, the Vietnamese government has announced plans to combat another problem, child malnutrition. From Hanoi, Owen Bennett-Jones reports.
Researchers found that obesity is most common amongst children from families with either high incomes or relatively few children. The Vietnamese government encourages families to have no more than two children, and it's thought that this has resulted in parents devoting ever more attention to the offspring they do have. The research found cases of young children daily eating four meals of rice and meat, washed down by a steady supply of fizzy drinks. But while some children in Vietnam are obese, many more, especially in rural areas, are malnourished. The government has just announced a plan to try to reduce the child malnutrition rate to 34% by the end of this year. Originally, it had a more ambitious target, but its plans were knocked off course by a series of natural disasters, like this year's flooding in the Mekong Delta. Nevertheless, substantial progress has been made. According to official figures, just 5 years ago, nearly half of Vietnamese children were malnourished. The economic reforms in Vietnam have led to an increasing gap between rich and poor, but the general improvement in economic performance means that while obesity rates are increasing, the number of children suffering from malnutrition is declining. But combating malnutrition does take time. On current projections, even getting the number of children suffering from the lack of a proper diet down to below 15% will take another 20 years.
Owen Bennett-Jones in Hanoi. You're listening to the BBC in London. Today's main news, the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is going to the Middle East to try to end the continuing clashes between Israelis and Palestinians. He says there's a risk that the conflict could escalate. Sanctions against Serbia are expected to be partially lifted when European Union foreign ministers meet in Luxembourg today. And there's been another case of a surge in the popularity of far-right political parties in Europe. In Belgium's local elections, the Vlaams Bloc has made gains in the Dutch-speaking region of Flanders. The party supports independence for the region and is fiercely anti-immigrant. It won a third of the vote in Belgium's second-largest city, Antwerp. The party leadership says it's been inspired by the success of the far-right Freedom Party in Austria. Geert van Klampert is a senior spokesman for the Vlaams Bloc.
What we are saying is really immigration has been going on too fast in Flanders and perhaps in other regions or areas of Europe too. We are not in principle against immigration, but we are against unbridled immigration. You cannot have thousands of people just coming to our country and not knowing Dutch, also many of them not feeling really, at least initially, interested in adjusting to our culture. You cannot expect that the local population is happy about it, and you cannot expect that there will not be problems.
All the other Belgian political parties have always agreed that they will not work with the Vlaams Bloc in any sort of coalition. Dick Sterk for the Belgian Liberal Party explains.
A number of people who vote for the Vlaams Bloc are not racist, are Flemish nationalists, traditional Flemish nationalists, who have no other party to go to because they think the independence of Flanders would be a good thing. I don't agree with that, but I can, with a nationalist, I can have an argument. But you cannot bring these two things together. And as long as they don't rewrite their program, I think we would ruin ourselves and destroy our own party if we would collaborate with them.
Dick Sterk from the Belgian Liberal Party. The electoral authorities in Lithuania say early results in the parliamentary elections show that two left-wing parties have gained the majority of votes, dealing a blow to the governing right-wing Homeland Union Party. The Social Democratic Coalition had 32% of the vote, followed by the centre-left New Union with almost 20%. The Homeland Union was trailing in fourth place with 8%. Correspondents say the Homeland Union has lost support because of its economic austerity policies. A group of 11 ambassadors from the member countries of the United Nations Security Council have arrived in West Africa at the start of a week-long trip to assess the situation in Sierra Leone. They start work this morning in Guinea, Sierra Leone's western neighbour, where they expect to meet the president, Lonsana Conte, and discuss the refugee situation in the country. Elizabeth Blunt reports on the Guinean capital, Conakry.
The United Nations is crucial to Sierra Leone. It's a 13,000-strong peacekeeping force, currently the largest UN mission in the world, which is providing what peace and security there is in the country. But Sierra Leone is equally crucial for the United Nations and its reputation. The peacekeeping force has suffered the humiliation of having hundreds of its members captured and held hostage. There have been disputes over the command of the force, and the Indian contingent, one of the best equipped and trained, has announced that it's pulling out. The Security Council will have important decisions to make in the weeks to come. So members clearly welcomed the chance to see the situation for themselves. 11 ambassadors have come. Only 4 Security Council members are not represented. Among those who've now arrived in the region, as well as the 5 permanent members, are ambassadors from Bangladesh and Ukraine, whose countries are expected to contribute additional troops to the peacekeeping force, Mali, which currently chairs the West African regional grouping, Jamaica, Canada, and the Netherlands. They start their visit with a morning of meetings in Guinea before traveling on to Sierra Leone for the main part of their fact-finding trip. The ambassadors also hope to meet the presidents of Mali, Nigeria, and Liberia before returning to New York in 1 week's time.
Liz Blunt in Conakry. The United Nations Special Envoy on Burma, Rezali Ismail, has arrived in Rangoon for talks with the military government on human rights. His visit comes at a time as the Burmese authorities renewed their attacks on Western countries, accusing the United States and Britain of plotting to get the UN and other international organisations to apply pressure to it. As well as government leaders, Mr. Rezali expects to meet the National League for Democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who's in conflict with the military authorities over her Right to Freedom movement. A museum dedicated to the life of John Lennon is opening to the public in Japan today on what would have been the former Beatles' 60th birthday. His widow, Yoko Ono, is in Japan to open the museum, which contains more than 100 items of memorabilia from the singer's life. Charles Scanlon reports from Tokyo.
The museum is set in the corner of a sports arena in a suburban area north of Tokyo. It's an unlikely spot for a museum dedicated to the former Beatle, who spent most of his life in Britain and the United States. But his widow, Yoko Ono, said John Lennon had a special love for Japan. She said his son was half Japanese, and they'd always felt they were somehow bridging the gap between East and West. Yoko Ono donated most of the items on display, including handwritten song lyrics, John Lennon's first guitar, and a pair of his wire-rimmed glasses. The museum is divided into separate zones featuring different aspects of the singer's life. Beatles songs play and there's an autobiographical film. John Lennon remains a popular figure in Japan 20 years after he was murdered and 30 years after the Beatles split up. Just last week, crowds gathered outside a record shop at midnight to buy the first copies of the Beatles' anthology, the official autobiography written by the group's surviving members.
Charles Scanlon in Tokyo. You're listening to the BBC in London. It's almost 7:20 GMT. Today's main news, the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is on his way to the Middle East to try to end several days of escalating violence between Israeli troops and Palestinian demonstrators. Sanctions against Serbia are expected to be partially lifted when European Union foreign ministers meet in Luxembourg today. BBC World Service, you're listening to World Briefing with Fiona MacDonald. Coming up in the next half hour, in World Business Review, examines the uncertainty surrounding the future of Korea's debt-ridden Daewoo Motors. And that's followed by a letter from America, Alistair Cook's weekly commentary on events in the United States, seen from the perspective of more than 50 years of reporting the American life to the world. But first, a summary of the latest world news with Roger Maud.
The United Nations Secretary-General Kofi Annan is on his way to the Middle East to try to end 11 days of violence between Israeli troops and Palestinian demonstrators. He's expected to meet both the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. The European Union is expected to agree today to lift some of its sanctions on Serbia, just days after the downfall of Slobodan Milosevic and the installation of Vojislav Koštunica as president. Mainstream political parties in Belgium have reiterated their refusal to cooperate with the far-right party, the Vlaams Blok, following its local election victories in the Dutch-speaking region of Flanders. The Prime Minister, Guy Verhofstadt, said the agreement to isolate the Vlaams Blok would prevent it from holding power. The first official results after the presidential election in Poland indicate that Aleksander Kwasniewski has been re-elected by a comfortable margin. Early figures broadcast on Polish television showed that he'd scored almost 55% of the vote, well above the 50% needed to avoid a second round. A new study in Vietnam shows that an increasing number of children there are suffering from obesity. Researchers at the Center for Nutrition in Ho Chi Minh City have found that almost 13% of children in the city are obese, and the figure is rising. The future direction of China's economic reform is expected to top the agenda as the country's senior leaders begin the annual plenary meeting of the Communist Party's Central Committee in Beijing today. The BBC correspondent in Beijing says China's imminent entry into the World Trade Organization will pose major new challenges to the country's outdated state-run industries. Tension is rising in Zimbabwe ahead of the return of the main opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, who faces arrest when he arrives back from South Africa in a few hours' time. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm joined now by Wendy Pascoe for her report on world business.
Who will buy South Korea's debt-ridden car maker Daewoo? After Ford pulled out, it seems the favourite is now General Motors. Plus the issues which will be making the business headlines for the week ahead, globally, and this morning highlighting Prague. And as the euro slides, how Europe's politicians are turning to the Middle East in an attempt to support the currency. First, though, these are difficult times for the troubled South Korean carmaker Daewoo. The debt-ridden firm was to have been sold to the US giant Ford, but the deal fell through last month, and now it looks as though Ford's rival General Motors could step in. Theo Leggett has the details.
There were protests in the streets of Seoul when South Korea's government announced plans to put Daewoo Motor on the market and to accept bids from foreign firms. Yet that didn't stop it from giving the Ford Motor Company exclusive rights to negotiate a $7 billion deal. But the plan fell through last month when Ford abruptly withdrew its bid. The government reacted with fury and said that the officials handling the sale should face the consequences of their failure. Daewoo Motor's chief of directors has already done so by offering his resignation. Ford's decision came as something of a surprise as the firm had battled to see off other potential bidders for Daewoo. But according to Graham Maxton of industry consultants Autopolis, it was the right move to make.
Ford's reason to pull out from Daewoo is not a sort of general concern about the markets or consolidation. It's a very specific case. In fact, Ford was desperate to get hold of a major acquisition in Asia and was even willing to pay over the odds to get Daewoo. But Daewoo is in some terrible financial condition, and they were, I think, right to walk away from it.
Ford's withdrawal was a body blow for Daewoo, but now it seems General Motors may be holding out an olive branch. Reports in the South Korean press say it signed a letter of intent to buy the Korean firm. GM's described the reports as speculation, but it has already made clear its interest in the firm. Analysts say Daewoo would now be expensive at anything over $3 billion. That's less than half of what Ford was prepared to pay. But the government has little choice. Its ambitious plans to restructure the country's unwieldy industrial conglomerates depend heavily on its success in disposing of loss-making assets such as Daewoo Motor.
That was Theo Leggett. Now to news of the stock markets in Asia, and Tokyo's Nikkei average is closed today. It's a public holiday in Japan, Sports Day. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index was down 3%. In points terms, that's down 482 at 15,702. Singapore's Straits Times Index fell 3.1%. Australia's All Ordinaries Index fell 0.6%. Bombay's 30-share Index up 0.2%. at 4100. In London, the 100-share index has just opened. It's down 0.6% at 63.51. Currencies now, and here are the latest London rates from Reuters. The dollar is up 0.2 Japanese yen at 109 yen. The euro up 0.1 cents at 87 US cents. The euro is also at 60.1 British pence, and the pound at $1.44.7. To the Czech Republic now, and much attention this week will be focused on the controversial commissioning of the Temelín nuclear power station near the Austrian border. The other principal news will be the health of the Prague Stock Exchange, which last week hit near record lows, as Andy Heil, editor of the Prague Business Journal, told me.
The market barely avoided lows for the year last year until Wednesday, when the government provided some real impetus to the market and decided that it would go ahead with the privatizations of utility ČEZ and Český Radiocom, which is the number two traded Czech telecom, and Unipetrol, a refiner. And the news is particularly good for the market, which has notoriously low liquidity, so really looking just for stocks to be traded. And the methods are being questioned slightly, but the news that these strategic partners are going to be brought in within the next even 18 months is still being welcomed by the markets.
How much attention is the commissioning of the Temelín nuclear power plant attracting?
Well, the Czech authorities are, I think, have done a very good job of encouraging discussion over the last year and a half. And so I think the Czech public is ready for Temelín to come online. Still some questions, some last-minute appeals from Austria, for example. Wolfgang Schüssel yesterday actually invited Prime Minister Miloš Zeman to delay any irreversible steps, but it looks like the Czech Nuclear Security Office is going to go ahead and give them approval, if they haven't already as we speak this morning, but that would mean they would fire it up within about the next 24 to 48 hours, and commercial operations would start as soon as next month.
Okay, and finally, if we can just return to shares. I understand you've got your first IPO coming up for, what, some 3 years?
Clearwave is the parent company to the Czech Republic's third GSM operator, also controls GSM operations in Romania. And it is not necessarily news that they're coming to market, but the fact that they're coming to the Prague Stock Exchange is likely to surprise a lot of people this week. There were clearly plans to go to NASDAQ and the London Stock Exchange, but the inclusion of the Czech market is going to be welcomed by traders. They say it's fantastic news and are looking forward to getting a good look at the prospectus.
That was Andy Heil in Prague. Well, let's widen it out and look ahead to the global economic issues which are likely to dominate the news in the week ahead. I started off by asking Bob McKee of the consultants Independent Strategy whether the decreasing price of a barrel of oil, currently hovering at around $30, was helping ease inflationary pressures and therefore reduce the likelihood of another interest rate rise on either side of the Atlantic.
Well, I think we've saw the Federal Reserve Bank in the US decided not to raise rates earlier this month, and they're beginning to think that inflation will stay reasonably benign, but they're not sure. And so we're in a position where the Fed is not sure. The European Central Bank just raised rates because they're not sure if inflation is going to pick up in Europe. So we're in this sort of limbo state where oil appears to be stabilizing in price, but we're still not sure whether the price rises we've seen in the past will feed through to inflation later on, or just simply into production costs squeezing profits. And what we've seen recently is that in the US, profits warnings coming from big companies, and there's some more this week giving figures, and we'll see again, is squeezing profits where the production costs from oil are coming through rather than prices. If that's the case, then the Fed will probably hold off for the rest of the year.
Because this the US producer price data was quite benign, wasn't it, relatively?
Well, the headline figure probably will show quite a sharp rise, but that's the oil. Once you take that out of the equation, you can see the underlying inflation figures, as in Europe also, are relatively benign. So that means that central banks don't really have a reason to raise rates if they think that that's going to continue. But it does mean that equity markets will suffer if production costs squeeze profits.
Let's switch focus for a second. second. There's an informal summit of EU leaders in Biarritz taking place at the moment. They've got an awful lot to talk about, formally or informally. Enlargement, for example, Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister's comment on the Senate. But the plight of the euro must be dominating their discussions a lot. It's around 87 cents again.
I think it will. We probably won't get much of a statement except their belief that European integration is going to succeed and the euro will also succeed. But at these levels of prices of exchange rate for the euro, it's only the central banks of Europe and the rest of the world that are stopping markets driving it further. There's no credibility in the currency yet. It seems that Europe's growth is not catching up with the US. In fact, it might be peaking. And so all that suggests that the euro is going to be in for a difficult time, at least for the rest of this year.
Bob McKee. From euro discussions in Biarritz to others in the Gulf, that's because European politicians and economists are hoping to persuade the Gulf Cooperation Council countries to embrace that much-unloved currency, the euro. They want to encourage more investment in it and also to make a case for the trade in oil to be denominated in euros rather than in US dollars. But as our correspondent Julia Wheeler reports from Dubai, many Gulf Arabs are still to be convinced.
I want to send money to Al-Rashid. What you want?
I want to send money to my wife.
When the expatriates of the UAE exchange their earnings in dirhams for their home currency, it's the value of the dollar they're watching. The local dirham is directly pegged to the US currency, and its fortunes vis-a-vis other currencies rise and fall alongside the dollar. Tourists here can pay their bills in dollars, and of course the price of the main export, oil, is quoted in dollars per barrel. This dollar dependency means those trying to improve the profile of the euro in the Gulf have a tough task ahead of them, a fact not lost on the single currency's founding father, Jacques Santer.
I can understand, because the euro is a new currency, the young currency, was launched only on the 1st of January 1999, so had not the possibility to make its first tests. The confidence is greater in other currencies like the dollar. It's more the strength of the dollar that's the weakness of the euro.
Europe is the GCC's biggest trading partner, which is a plus for the euro's promoters. But what they'd also like to see is the eurozone receiving a bigger share of the $1.1 trillion analysts estimate is currently invested in the US and Europe by GCC Arabs. But those same Gulf Arabs are wary. The Director General of the Arab Monetary Fund, based in Abu Dhabi, is Dr. Jassim Al-Manai, a Bahraini.
The euro is still struggling, really, to establish itself as international currency. It has lost already more than 25% of its initial value. However, I think the euro project is attractive. It's very exciting. It needs probably some time, some patience to get the final result. But I'm sure it's an experience to watch.
Arabs listening to the arguments for direct investment in European capital markets are also aware of the broader issues, including whether GCC ties to the dollar should be loosened in favour of a closer relationship with the euro. In other words, the pegging of Gulf dinars, dirhams and rials to a basket of currencies, including the euro. It's being mooted at several levels, but the Assistant Secretary General for Economic Affairs at GCC headquarters in Riyadh, Ajlan Al-Kuwari, can't see it happening in the near future.
I don't think that's realistic, really. We are very clearly dollar-based countries. Our revenues are based on dollars. However, I think, you know, the euro will play a major role in GCC economies, considering that Europe are the main player of our export-import balance.
That I don't perceive any objective and serious weakness.
Jacques Santer also wants future oil prices to be quoted in euros, saying it would stabilise relations between Arab producers and European consumers. Playing to the gallery, Mr. Santer also pointed to US foreign policy as a reason for the move. But politics or economics, Gulf Arabs are not yet convinced. It'll be some time yet before anyone here starts looking for the euro rate as an indication of their money's value.
That was Julia Wheeler in Dubai. Other news briefly now, and the Kyoto Mutual Life Insurance Company has collapsed and filed for court protection from its creditors. It's the biggest failure yet in Japan's life insurance sector. Kyoto had assets worth some $32 billion, but it had been suffering from a persistent gap between the returns it was receiving on investments and payments promised to shareholders. Japan's Financial Services Agency said in a statement the firm had attempted to restructure its activities, but had been hit by persistently poor business conditions. Now back to the commodity markets. Gold is trading at $270.55 an ounce. That's up 55 cents from Friday afternoon's London fix. The Australian dollar is trading at 53.42 US cents, and the US dollar is at 1 Swiss franc 74.8 and at 46.08 Indian rupees. That's it from World Business Report. Now back to Fiona.
Thanks, Wendy. That was Wendy Pascoe with the business news. It's almost 7:45 GMT, the latest world headlines from the BBC World Service. The United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is going to the Middle East to try to end the continuing clashes between Israelis and Palestinians. He says there's a risk of the violence escalating. Sanctions against Serbia are expected to be partially lifted when European Union foreign ministers meet in Luxembourg today. The main political parties in Belgium are joining forces against a far right-wing party after it made big gains in local elections in the Dutch-speaking region of Flanders.